Well, I grew up in the 80s, by the way. I don't know anybody else who grew up in the 80s, but legends were made in the 80s. I'll tell you that. It's all coming back around. My kids, they listen to music I was growing up. It's all thanks to Cobra Kai and Stranger Things and all sorts of stuff like that. But the 80s were legendary. Some amazing things happened in the 80s. And as a matter of fact, there was an amusement park. Some of you have heard of this. There was an amusement park in the 80s that existed in Vernon Township, New Jersey. And it was called Action Park. And some of you know this because it was made famous by a television show. I'll talk about that in a second. But the owner, he set out to create the most thrilling and extreme amusement park experience anywhere. And he did this by basically taking the designs of professional engineers that designed their rides. And then he, after they got approved, he would make them taller and steeper and faster and basically more thrilling and overall more exciting. And really crazy stuff happened. In fact, I'm not even going to have to tell you about it because I'm going to show you. So take a look at this.
There's nothing in the world like Action Park, where you're the center of the action. It's bigger and better than ever. Something for everyone looking for fun. Get ready for the action.
Catch the action with over 50 rides, shows, and attractions at the world's largest participation park, where you and the rides become one. You're just minutes away.
There's nothing in the world like Action Park.
And there was nothing wrong with promoting a place like this, by the way. And I'll just, in case you missed it really fast, did anybody see this? We had one another shot of this really quick. I mean, who thought this was a good idea? I mean, lots of people, broken noses, lost teeth. I mean, this was sort of as much as there could be a no rules park. This was it. And it was crazy. I mean, lots of people got hurt. There were not a lot of rules. They served alcohol at this park. True story. People died at this park. I mean, it was not good. And we don't even know how many because some of them were covered up. And that's why this was created. There was a show. Some of you saw this called Class Action Park. And this park became world famous for being the most dangerous amusement park there was. And my youth pastor took us there every summer. In a 15-passenger van, by the way, which is a death trap. And we would go every summer, no waivers, no oversight, no parents. Kids always came back bloodied, bruised, battered. And somehow he would get to take us back the next summer again. Dude was a legend, by the way. Which is the only thing that has anything to do with what we're talking about today. That guy actually came a long way because he's now one of our best group directors. His name's Bill Opperman. He works on our staff here at North Point, which is pretty awesome. If you see Bill, give him a hard time. So we're in this series, the choices legends are made of. And I have to say thanks to Clay and Andy because they set me up well and they left the best story. We've looked at stories in chapter 1 and 6 from the book of Daniel, some of these legendary stories and what we can learn from the choices that Daniel and his friends made. And today, we're going to look at a really famous story in Daniel chapter 3. That's my cue. If you have a Bible or if you have a device that you want to follow along, I'd love for you to follow along in your Bible. Daniel chapter 3. We're going to do the whole chapter. I'm going to summarize some of it as we go through. But the other thing I thought would be helpful today, because we have a little bit of space, is I want to talk about how you read an Old Testament narrative. Because, and as we go through, some of you read the Old Testament, you read stories, and you're like, what does that have to do with anything? So as we walk through it today, I'm going to actually show you how you figure that out. And when it comes to Old Testament narratives, and this was something I was taught a long time ago that's really easy to remember, you want to think through three lenses: that world, their world, and our world. That world, their world, and our world. And if you were taught other ways to read the Bible, this is very similar to observation, interpretation, application. As you're trying to read something you don't understand, if you run it through this grid, it becomes a lot easier. So that world, the context, let's just talk about that real quick of the stories of Daniel. This is the Babylonian attack on Jerusalem. This is early 6th century. This is the first attack on Jerusalem. And about 10,000 Israelites were deported and were carried off into exile into Babylon. And this included Daniel and his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who many of you know is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And that's the story we're going to talk about today. But these Israelites that were carried off into exile, they were re-educated, they were renamed, and many times they were pressured to assimilate into the culture there. And so that was sort of what was happening in that world. Now, when it comes to their world, we want to consider what's happening in with the original audience. So that world, that's what happened in Daniel's world. They were carried off in exile, but that's not who the story was being written to. The original audience was a group of Israelites that were back in Jerusalem. This is after they were released from exile, a whole bunch of, not all of them, but a whole bunch of Israelites returned. And so these stories were preserved and they were written to people back in Jerusalem who were returned to a place that felt anything like home. And here's one of the interesting things about it is in Daniel, if you were reading it in the original language, the first chapter is written in Hebrew. And then the stories, chapters 2-7, these stories are written in Aramaic, which was the official language of Babylonian Empire, and then the Persians that ever ended up taking them over. So that was sort of the original language there. And part of the reason is for credibility's sake. So some of you think, like, did these stories actually happen? Well, the writer actually wrote it in a language that, and again, many of these people were still alive, that people who were living back in Babylon could read the stories and go, yep, that actually happened. I was there. So there was some credibility involved in this, the historicity of it, but also to make it accessible to people that were Gentiles, the non-Jewish audience. And this is a theme throughout Daniel about the one true God and who the one true God was. So we're going to get to the our world part a little bit later as we unpack this story. So let's jump in. Daniel chapter 3, if you're with me, here's how it starts. King Nebuchadnezzar, who's the king at that time, made a gold statue 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So this is just southeast of the main city center in Babylon. And this, if just for context, this statue is almost the size of the Statue of Liberty. So this isn't small. This is a massive statue just outside the city. And actually, you can go today. Archaeologists have actually uncovered a space where there's a platform that's 45 by 45 that's like the perfect size of what something would be needed. And it's just southeast where they believe the plain of Dura was, just southeast of Babylon. A platform is there, and they found inscriptions on it that connect it to Nebuchadnezzar II, which is the king of Babylon at this time, at the time of the story. So this is like, there's a lot of history that supports the fact that these stories actually happened. So King Nebuchadnezzar, he builds this statue, and then he collects all the leaders and all the officials, all the important people from all over the province of Babylon, and he brings them to this plain of Dura. And skipping down to verse 4, there's a herald. So they got all the people together, and this herald shouted to all the people of all races and nations and languages, listen to the king's command. So here's what the king, here's why he built this statue, and it's really most people believe is a statue of himself. When you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and other musical instruments, bow down to the ground to worship King Nebuchadnezzar's golden statue. So this is what's being decreed. This is the decree that the king's written down in this herald or this spokesperson, the person's reading this decree of the king, that this is what they're supposed to do. And anyone who refuses to obey will be immediately thrown into a blazing furnace. And here's the thing, you don't go against the king's decrees. And so as the music played, all the people who were gathered that day, the officials and stuff, all the people seemingly bowed down to this golden statue that the king had set up. But some of the Chaldeans went to the king and informed the Jews. The Chaldeans were, your translation might say astrologers. These were a highly educated class of Babylonian advisors to the king. They were sort of the intellectual elites. And these were people that were well-educated in astrology and in science and in the supernatural things. And oftentimes they were the people the king looked to most for advisors. In fact, in chapter 2, the king had a dream. If you were reading the story right before this, king had a dream, and these advisors couldn't interpret his dream. And so what King Nebuchadnezzar did was he was trying to find out if there was anybody else, but Daniel, he found out about this, and Daniel said, I can interpret this dream, and he asked his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, to pray for him, that God would reveal the meaning of this dream to him. So he does. He goes to the king and he interprets the dream. And in doing so, he actually saves these guys' lives. He basically says, hey, look, this was a difficult dream. You should spare these guys' lives. So these guys' lives were spared by him. But what happened in the process is they got bypassed by Daniel. He became the highest rank in the province of Babylon. And he brought with him his friends. And he elevated Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to oversee all the daily affairs. Now, here's why this is important. Because the Chaldeans are not happy. Because they've been displaced. They've lost something. And so they've recognized something. And they came to inform the king on these Jews that he had put in charge. And this is what they said. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, long live the king. So you know the kind of suck-ups these guys are. You issued a decree requiring all the people to bow down and worship the gold statue when they hear the sounds of the, I won't list them all again, all these musical instruments. The decree states that those who refuse to obey must be thrown into burning furnace. You remember this. This was your decree, king. You know, you're great. You're amazing. You made this decree, and everybody should bow down. If they don't, there's consequences. But here's what you need to know. There are some Jews, specifically Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you've put in charge. I mean, you know, by way of Daniel. But you put them in charge over the province of Babylon. They're overseeing the daily affairs. They're basically an extension of your rule, an extension of your power. And they pay no attention to you, your majesty. They refuse to serve your gods and do not worship the golden statue that you've set up. Then King Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage, and he ordered that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought before him. And when they were brought in, King Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Is it true? Is it true that you refuse to serve my gods or to worship the golden statue I've set up? I've put you in charge. I've made you an extension of me. You have a prominent place in my kingdom. I've elevated you, even though you're not of this land. You're from a foreign land. You're sort of aliens in this land. I've given you this leadership role. Here's what I'm going to do. I will give you one more chance to bow down, to worship the statue I've made when you hear the sound of the musical instruments. But if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. Now, this is a strange story. I mean, we don't deal with things in our world this way. And sometimes you read these stories in the Bible and you go, well, what do I do with that? I mean, that I've never been in that situation, but maybe you have. And as bizarre as this story seems, I want to connect it to our world. So I want to come back to this for a second, and I want you to understand. So Babylon represents this foreign place or this foreign land. It's not their home. They're not tourists there. They're not immigrants. They're exiles. There are people there, but they're living there for a period of time. If they could go home, they would. But they're stuck there, and they're in this foreign land, and they're not there by choice. They're exiles in this foreign land. And in this story, Daniel, the book of Daniel, there, it includes stories about how these people should live in that way, how to participate, how to add value, how to impact while resisting either conformity or compromise. So how do you live in that world? And so that's what these stories are about in that world. And they're written, though, to people who were released from Babylon. They're written to people who are back in Israel, and they're occupied also. So later, as they return back to Jerusalem, Jerusalem is no longer a sovereign state. It's been taken over, and they're later not only ruled by the Babylonians, but the Persians and eventually the Romans. And what this is really about is about faithful living without political or social or moral control. So this is where it connects to your world and to my world. We often find ourselves in situations where there's outside pressures. There's pressures above us, whether they're political or they're social or they're moral, they're corporate. You have pressures to act and live in certain ways that affect the way you live, and you have decisions you have to make. Now, this statue, it represents, you know, King Nebuchadnezzar, his imperial power, the Babylonian Empire, but it sort of, to their original audience, it was anything that was held up that they were supposed to bow down to, anything that they were supposed to assimilate to, or anything they were supposed to change their Jewish nature to accommodate to. And it's really about any great power or authority or dominance that is asserting its power on you. And in our free society, it's hard to experience this because it's a little bit different, but this is someone or something that's opposing its will on you. Again, it could be a social or a societal norm or professional influence in your world or a professional authority in your world. And there's some sort of authority or power structure that's set up, and we don't think about it this way, but your decision is to either bow to this or to somebody who's trying to assert their will in your life or trying to control you. Again, this could be relational, this could be professional, but your choice is to either bow to that or to do something else. And the furnace, obviously, it was a real furnace in their world, but this is the real world pressure that people lived in when they lived under an authority or they lived in the midst of influences that they didn't want to conform to. And whether by force or by choice, they experienced this intense pressure to align their lives or pledge their allegiance to something. And you and I, we experience this all the time in our culture. And there are consequences that are associated with refusing to conform. Humanly, there's a common response to this. And this is where this sort of gets a little bit fun. I know it doesn't seem so fun, but it gets a little bit fun. And I don't want you to say this out loud, but there's two common human responses to this sort of pressure when we're dealing with things like this in our life that are affecting us in negative ways that we don't appreciate or we don't want. There's two primary ways in which we respond. And if you know what these are, I don't want you to say them out loud yet. We're all going to say them out loud together in a second. But I want you to think about how you normally respond. When you're experiencing a pressure that either you don't appreciate or it's something that you would say is not something that you want to conform to, or somebody's trying to control you, you experience one of two emotions. And these emotions cause you to do things. And again, in different situations, you may respond differently. But the fact is most of us respond in one of two ways on a regular basis. And there's reasons, by the way, that these are common human emotions. But we do one of two things. We either fight or we flight. And I know there's more, and depending on who you talk to, depending on psychologists, I've read them all. There's three for some, there's five for some, but the reason these are the two primaries, because these are the two things that we commonly respond to because of our physiological makeup. And you may not know this about yourself, but when you're in a situation where you're feeling pressure, and it could be significant pressure, it could be like, you know, you're like in danger. Or it could just be the pressure that you feel from somebody who's trying to control you in your life, or somebody who's misbehaving and you're not sure how to respond to this, and you feel threatened or you feel in danger, or you feel out of control. What happens is your body releases certain hormones, and you know this, it releases things like adrenaline or cortisol. And what that does is it prepares your body to either fight or flee, to either engage in the fight or to run away. And the truth is when we feel like someone's forcing us or forcing their values on us or trying to control us or to pressure us to conform or to compromise, we react in one of these two ways. And here's what we do. And this is probably even more specific of what we do. We either choose, and some of you, the truth some of you are predisposed to this. You either choose aggressive confrontation, which, really quick, I'm just going to make you out yourself real quick. Aggressive confrontation types. Come on, raise your hand. Be proud. I'm this type. Like, there's something I'm dealing with. I'm like, let's hit it head on. Let's talk about it. We're going to deal with it right now. Or there's, and not as many people are going to want to admit this one, or there's passive accommodation. You're like, yeah, well, they didn't really mean that. That wasn't really the issue. And you know what? We'll kind of let that slide, or we'll see what happens. And anybody you're like conflict avoidant a little bit? Okay, so these are my activists. And these are the people that are more avoidant. And this is exactly what we see in our culture. It's what you think. Think about the culture wars. Think about the political landscape. Isn't it true this is what we witness? You see people either who come out swinging and they're all over their social media. You've seen them. You've unfollowed them, all of that stuff. So, and then there's people who are just like, I'm not touching that. I'm not doing anything with that. Everybody can do whatever they want. Like, can't we just all get along? Can't we just all be happy? And this is how we respond. But it's not just to politics. It's politics in your office, in your kids' schools, in your kids' sports. And this is how we respond in the pressures of marriage and societal pressures and other family and relational pressures. This is how we respond. And we naturally bend towards one of these two. And the truth is they're both connected to one thing. They're both rooted in the same thing. The truth is they're both rooted in fear. And the reason they're both rooted in fear and there may be past trauma that there isn't actually real present danger in your life, but there's past trauma that causes you to react. And it sort of triggers you in this way. But the reason these responses are reactions to fear is because what we're trying to do is we're trying to avoid something. And so when we choose one of these two things, here's what we're trying to avoid. What we're trying to avoid is we're trying to avoid the fire. You and I don't want to be in the fire. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't really want to be in the fire either. I want you to think about this for a second. They elude the fire by either coordinating an attack on the king and overthrowing the king, or by saying nothing and just either avoiding or fleeing or conforming to what's going on. They don't want to be in the fire. But they don't do either one of these things. They don't attack the king and they don't passively conform. And here's why I don't think they do either. It's because they're not afraid. They're not afraid. Why is that? It's not because the fire isn't real. The fire's real. In fact, this is the story. If you refuse, you'll be thrown immediately into the burning flames. The burning flame, why can I not say that? The blazing furnace. You're gonna be thrown in. And so they're facing the fire. And beyond that, they're being taunted. King Nebuchadnezzar says, and here's the deal. And what God, then what God will be able to rescue you from my power? When you're being coerced or you're being affected or somebody's trying to control you, you're trying to figure out, how do I regain control? How do I get out of this? How do I avoid the fire? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they don't fight. They don't run. In fact, this is how they respond. They replied and they said, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. So interesting. They're being threatened. They don't feel like they need to defend themselves. They say, if we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, don't miss this. He's able to save us. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden statue that you have set up. Our God is the only one worthy of the place of ultimate authority in our life. We're not going to compromise. We're not going to conform. But we will refuse to bow to the idols. We refuse to position lesser things as ultimate things in our lives. We're not going to give anything else that amount of power, not even you. They resisted aggressive confrontation. They're not attacking him. And they refused to passively accommodate. Instead, they chose an alternative. There is an alternative. There's a way to act. There's an appropriate response in the midst of this. And what they chose instead was faithful presence. They chose to honor their God as their ultimate authority, to trust in him to deliver them. They chose a faithful presence, even if that meant facing the fire. You know what's interesting? This is the same posture that Jesus modeled. So that world, their world, our world, we're Jesus followers in our world, in this world. We're not Jewish people in a foreign land being controlled, but we are in a foreign land where we're even taught throughout the Bible that we're just passing through this world. This world's not our home. And as Jesus followers, as Christians, what does it look like to live in a world where we don't have ultimate control? We don't have ultimate authority. We don't have ultimate power. This is something Jesus faced over and over in the world that he lived in. Between the religious leaders and the Roman Empire, he was constantly facing the fire. And John described him as full of two things. You know this. He was full of what? Grace and truth, or truth and grace. I reordered them for the sake of my board. So he's full of truth and grace. And this is important. We've talked about this before. In fact, if there's something that has been such a gift to me in my life that I've learned from Andy over and over, this is years ago, and he's been harped on this so much. This is so important that Jesus wasn't one or the other, and he wasn't half and half. He was full on grace and full on truth. And we walk into circumstances, we face these situations. This is the question. How do we choose to be full of grace and full of truth, not leaving out any of the truth and not dumbing down any of the grace? How do you maintain and hold on to both? And when we choose one or the other, we choose not to live as Jesus followers. We don't choose his way. And here's what happens. And some of you, you've experienced this. You've been the victim of this. When people are all about the truth and it's just all truth and no grace, here's what happens. They condemn, and you felt condemned. Some of you, because of somebody's truth bomb in your life, you felt like they didn't care about you, they didn't see you. And others of you, because of a lack of truth and only grace, you felt like confused, like, wait, are we supposed to just conform? Or is somebody condoning these things? And this is what happens when there's truth without grace or grace without truth, is we find ourselves in this situation where we're condemning aggressive opposition or confrontation, or condoning this passive accommodation. And we're called to do neither of those. Instead, the question for you and the question for me is, in those situations, what does faithful presence look like in the midst of your circumstances, even if it means entering the fire? Because it usually means entering the fire. And our natural inclination is to avoid the fire in the face of the pressures of culture and society and marriage and family and business. When you're feeling the natural inclination or the pressure to come out swinging or to just ignore or to avoid, what does it look like for you to be faithfully present? Here's what's interesting. This is why this story is brilliant. It's a brilliant story, and it's so relevant, because the answer to that question, you have to go back, because the first step is to identify what your idols are. What are you tempted to bow down to? This is a question we don't ask often in our world. What are your idols? What are the things that you've made ultimate in your life, that you've chosen to give power in your life, that you reorder your life around, that you serve, a person or a pursuit, or maybe it's a thing or an ideology or a political party? What's in your life worth bending your life around or bending your knee to? What do you give allegiance to over and above the authority of God and how he's instructed you to live, which they were instructed not to bow down to any other authority, and to not do that was to face the fire. And they had to decide if they were gonna bend to this or serve this idol or not. This is the story. This is why the story is relevant. And in our world, that looks like things like comfort and success and power and pleasure. And these are the things we serve. Most of our idols are in one of these categories. And these are things in order to obtain these things or maintain these things or continue to hold on to these things. We serve them and we make them ultimate in our lives. And it causes us to fight against anything that will take it away from us or to run away from and avoid situations and circumstances that are gonna cause me to have to live in such a way where I'd lose one of these things. And here's what I tell you. That's what an idol is. So how do you know? Here's the second question. Second question is, what do you fear? What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of losing most? You should think about that. You should reflect on that, because whatever that thing is in your life that you fear losing the most, it has power. It has authority in your life. Jesus actually prayed, John 17, he prayed for you and he prayed for me. He prayed that we would know that God would protect us and we would know how to live in this world, but not of the world. That Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 2, when he was instructing Jesus' followers, and this is instructive for us as well, he says, look, we don't belong to this world. We're resident aliens living in exile. Same thing. We're living in exile in this world. I wonder what would happen if Jesus' followers today chose to live as exiles in our Babylon. That's what we're in our Babylon, as exiles in this world, choosing faithful presence to the one we've chosen to make ultimate in our lives. Here's what happened for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They became legends. Legends. Some of you know the end of the story. Nebuchadnezzar was furious. He heated the furnace 7 times hotter. They're thrown in the fire. When they're thrown in the fire, some of his officials, his guards are burned up just trying to throw them into the fire. But suddenly, we're told, Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in amazement and he exclaimed to his advisors, didn't we tie up 3 men and throw them into the furnace? And this is gonna make sense of the song that we've sung over and over and over. And you're like, who's the 4th man in the fire? I have no idea what this song is talking about. This is where it comes from. This is what it says, Your Majesty, we certainly did. They replied to him, look, Nebuchadnezzar shouted, I see 4 men. There were 3 that were thrown in there, but I see 4 men unbound walking around the fire unharmed. And the 4th one looks like a god. And he shouted for them to be taken out of the fire. So they come out of the fire. When they got out of the fire, him and all the other officials were amazed that they were completely unharmed. Not a hair on their head singed, not their clothes not burned. They didn't even smell like smoke, we're told. And then Nebuchadnezzar said this. He said, praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. There is no other God who can save. No other God who can rescue like this. Nebuchadnezzar learned something that day. And it was something that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not just believed, but that they trusted. They chose to trust that their God could save and that he would rescue. But even if he didn't, they weren't gonna bow down. They were gonna choose to face the fire. And here's one of the things I've learned in my life is oftentimes when we're facing difficult situations like this, when we're facing the fire, we think God's trying to teach us something about ourselves, which is true sometimes. Sometimes he's trying to teach you something about you. That's the case. But I found many more times in the midst of the fire, God's trying to teach us something about him. He's trying to teach us that when we face the fire, he can be trusted, that he is the ultimate authority, that he's in control, and that he will be with us. I want you to know this. I have faced the fire in my life many times. I've been through very challenging situations, dealt with significant brokenness and betrayal and challenging things in life. Because I stand on a stage up here and have a title of pastor, I'm no different from you. I deal with the same things in my family and in my workplace and as many of you do. The same difficult things. I've wrestled with difficult decisions and oftentimes knew what I ought to do. I knew exactly what God wanted to do. I know, like many of you do, what faithful presence looks like when I thought about it. But I was afraid. I was afraid. I was afraid of what I would lose, what would be taken away from me. I've never in my life heard the audible voice of God, but in the midst of one of those fires in my spirit, I heard the strangest thing. Like into my head came this phrase, and I felt like God was saying to me, I'm not afraid. Which I thought, of course you're not, you're God. He said, I'm not afraid. I'll be with you in the fire, and I'm not afraid of what this will mean for you on the other side of it. I'm not afraid for your future. I'm not afraid for your family. Will you trust me with your faithful presence? Will you do the next right thing? Will you not do what feels natural, either fight back or flee? And I suddenly, in the midst of that, this is a few years ago, I had this flashback of swimming with my dad, and we were in this river, and the rapids picked up, and we got in this really dangerous part of the river, and the current became really strong, and it was just taking me, and my dad was with me, and we're floating down, and I was terrified, and my dad was right there, and I looked at him, and when I looked at his face, I saw no panic on his face. I was looking at him, and he just smiled. And he reached out his hand. And that's how this felt. It's how it felt when I felt like God said, I'm not afraid. When I looked at my dad's face that day, I thought, he's not afraid. And he's with me. And it gave me the courage to walk through the fire. If you're facing a fire today, if you're in the fire, your God is with you. And he is not afraid. There is no other God who can rescue like our God. There is no other God who delivers like our God. There is no other thing in this world that we prop up as a God or as an idol that we serve that can rescue, that can deliver, that can see you through the flames and through the fires that we all inevitably face in life. Like our God. So what does it look like for you, for us, in the world that we live in, the times that we live in, the circumstances we face, to live with a faithful presence, trusting in our God? That's what legends are made of. Let me pray for you. God, I pray for somebody who's here today, and as I was talking the whole time, a certain circumstance they're facing, they're in the middle of it right now, and they're terrified. I pray that they would know you're not surprised by that. And the fact is, the situation is probably terrifying. I pray that they would hear you whisper to them today, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid for you. I'm not afraid for your future. I'm not afraid for your family. I'm not afraid of any of the outcomes. And I'm with you in the midst of that fire. I pray you give them the courage to trust you, to do the next right thing, to do the thing that they know they ought to, the thing that they know you're calling them to, the thing that represents faithful presence in their life. I pray you give them the courage and the strength to follow through and do it. And that you'd be faithful to meet them in the midst of it. And they would sense your presence right next to them, right with them. In the midst of the fire, and I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.